the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSB, in Santa Cruz. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Michael Goldfarb joins us this week, a familiar voice to NPR listeners. Michael Goldfarb was NPR's London Bureau Chief for a number of years, and his latest book is Emancipation: How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. Michael Goldfarb, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much.
Well, I want to talk about emancipation, but I have a sort of a big question that I want to ask you first. A Christian is someone who believes in Christ, and that is, that Jesus is the Son of God. And a Christian decides to be a Christian, or to remain a Christian. But is a Jew something more than just someone who follows the Jewish faith?
That was the big question at the time of emancipation. And it's still a big question in the Jewish community. You know, there isn't a lot of dogma in Judaism. There is the people, the chosen people, selected by God to, you know, fulfill his commandments and his mitzvot, and you're born into the community, although since the emancipation era, people have been converting. It's not a proselytizing religion. And the essential question is it possible to be a Jew without necessarily following those commandments? And, you know, in the modern era, pretty clearly, yes. It's a kind of not quite ethnicity, not quite, unless you live in Israel, a national identity. It's a unique situation on the face of the earth. And in my book, I mean, in Emancipation, the Emancipation era posed the basic identity question: can you be Jewish without following Judaism?
And that's still a major question. I mean, I was always taught that it was anti-Semitic to hold the idea that Judaism was a race or a nationality.
Post-Holocaust, it's a pretty grim thing to say. But, you know, when the whole question of what to do with the Jews first came up in the modern era, which was at the time of the French Revolution, France's Jews, there weren't that many of them. Most of them were living ghettoized existence in the eastern part of France, in Alsace and Lorraine. And the idea of giving them equal rights to other Frenchmen was hotly debated. They're a nation within the nation. Jews were seen as a separate nation right the way across Europe. And this created a huge problem for reformers. They had to decide whether, and for the Jewish people themselves. If you're born on French soil, are you a Frenchman who happens to be Jewish? In the same way that, you know, if you're born in America and you're brought up Jewish, you know, you're an American who happens to be Jewish. And this was some incredible identity question that had to be answered. And unfortunately, the final answer came in the form of the Holocaust.
Yes, the final solution, right?
The final solution, the final answer, yeah.
Well, in America, when blacks were slaves, the idea was that blacks were seen as less than human, somewhere between animal and human. Were Jews viewed in this same way?
They were humiliated in that way. For example, in the ghetto times, right up to the end of the ghetto time, in France, for example, if a Jew went into a city from another part of the country, he had to pay an identical tax as a donkey or, you know, some lumbering oxen crossing into the city. It's called a poll tax, and so thus equated with an animal. Jews were considered, in my research, I kept coming across things like Jews are Asians, Jews are Africans, Jews are Arabs, anything but what they, you know, what we manifestly are, which is, you know, we're Caucasian people. And or at least at the time, Caucasian people. So it wasn't quite the same as being three-fifths of a man, but it was certainly being considered far less than those who claimed to be natives of the soil. And the funny thing, of course, is that, you know, Jews had been part of the European tapestry of peoples from at least Roman times, and in many cases they had been part of the neighborhood longer than, say, the Frankish tribes or the Germanic tribes that invaded, you know, in the Dark Ages.
Well, now today, there are about 2 billion Christians and about 14 million Jews, I believe. And is that about the same proportion in the 18th and 19th century, or were there substantially more Jews prior to the Holocaust?
Rarely were there more, was the population of Europe in any place more than 1% Jewish. I mean, in France, at the time of the Revolution, and France was the first place where Jews were let out of the ghetto, there was a population in 1789, the year of the Revolution, was about 26 million, and there were 40,000 Jews, so less than 0.1%,
mm-hmm.
if that. But they were an obsession. And, of course, once they were let out of the ghetto, as the cities began to grow in the 19th century, I mean, as people moved in from, you know, an agrarian lifestyle into the urban lifestyle, in the larger cities, Jews were frequently 10-12%. In Budapest, they were a quarter of the population, 25%. So that was quite a significant minority.
Now, your book focuses on Europe, but were Jews, how were they treated in the United States at the beginning of the United States?
Well, interestingly, there was a very, very small community of mostly Sephardic Jews who, you know, had come to the U.S. kind of through a long process of history, where following the expulsion from Spain and then Portugal, and then they in the Caribbean and in Brazil, and then had worked their way up into the U.S. And they were greeted with open arms by the young country. In fact, George Washington famously went to a congregation in Rhode Island and said, "You're always welcome here, and we welcome your skills and abilities," because, you know, here's this young country that he's leading in rebellion against the British, and in so doing, he's basically cutting off his Virginia tobacco farming colleagues from the markets of the Caribbean and Latin America. And here were this small group of people who had trading connections right the way across the Caribbean and down to Brazil and over into the Mediterranean. So he was quite happy to have their skills around. Later on, as the immigration from Europe got underway in the middle of the 19th century, first from the German-speaking world, the Jews encountered the same prejudices that every other immigrant group coming into America encountered, whether they were Irish or later on Italians and then the Russian Jews and so on. But, you know, there was room to expand, there was room to move, and there was a great big continent to get across. So the prejudices were not organized, and they certainly weren't condoned by the state. So I would say they had a slightly better reception in America than they did coming out of the ghetto in Europe.
Well, the thing that I found most surprising when I read your book is that, you know, I think we have an idea, you know, from Shalom Aleichem or whatever, that Eastern Europe is the place where the pogroms were and where Jews were oppressed. But really, all over Europe, Jews were ghettoized.
That's right. I mean, a very intelligent Jewish friend of mine, I was explaining, "Oh, I'm writing this book about when the Jews came out of the ghetto." And she said, "Oh, you mean after the Warsaw Uprising in 1943?
Really?
And
that
I
was
said,
the only
No. There were ghettos. Not just in Venice. I mean, segregation was total across Europe from about the time of the Black Death. And in urban areas, it was ghettos with gates. And, you know, because most of the population of Europe was living, you know, in rural areas, most Jews lived in little settlements out in the countryside, very similar to the kind of African-American hamlets that still exist in the Mississippi Delta, where, you know, you came up to town to do your trade during the day, and then at night you had to go back to, you know, the place to which you were segregated out in the countryside. And when the French Revolution happened, the Jews of France were liberated. And then that was probably a very good thing. They were emancipated. But then the revolution went to hell in a handbasket, and you had the Reign of Terror, and that act sort of got subsumed in all the other chaos and bloody anarchy. And on the far side of that, Napoleon emerged. And it was Napoleon who really went across Europe, and everywhere he went, he brought the Code Napoleon, guaranteeing the rights of man and the citizen to the peoples of Europe. And rather like we've discovered in places like Iraq, you can't give people their freedom at the point of a sword. They tend not to be too terribly grateful for it. So there was a lot of resentment about this liberation. But in Western Europe, Jews were segregated and isolated, and in many cases more restricted than they were in the areas where most American Jewish families can trace their ancestry, which is, Eastern Poland, the Baltic states, and Russia.
We're talking with Michael Goldfarb, and his book is called Emancipation, How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. So talk a little bit about that second half of your subtitle. Considering that Jews are a small population in the world, there certainly are a lot of prominent ones, but that wasn't always the case.
No, that wasn't the case. During this time of segregation, you never hear about Jews. I mean, you hardly hear a Jewish name, except for perhaps two great teachers who are not necessarily known outside the Jewish community. One, Moses Maimonides, is generally known. The other is a teacher and sage called Rashi. But really, it was a very inward-looking life. And then what happened was suddenly allowed out of the ghetto. Okay, you can be French. You can be German. You can be whatever after 500 years of being told you can't be anything like that. And for some, those who, not everyone in the community raced out to grab this new identity. But once you made that choice, or the choice was made for you by your parents, there was no going back, and yet the majority population was hardly standing there with open arms. I mean, some were, but some were indifferent, some were open arms, and there were a fair number who sort of didn't want to know you. And it was a very confusing time. And, today it's nothing for Americans, or at least Americans who listen to public radio, to be aware of, identity questions that are attendant on, the first generation of, born in America of immigrant parents, whether they're Mexican-Americans or, Asian-Americans, Haitian-Americans. It doesn't matter. Everyone understands that finding your identity when you've left behind a long, sturdy tradition in a new world is a very difficult process. And what happened, I think, is that those people of talent, particularly those of talent with words, like the poet Heinrich Heine, for example, or thinkers like Karl Marx, in trying to solve their own personal identity questions, were desperately trying to carve out a space for themselves in this new Europe. And so they theorized, they wrote books. And they came up with revolutionary new ideas for how Western society should be organized. And it isn't just Marx. I mean, we think of him as a political thinker. But, you look at Freud and you look at Einstein. And it is, Freud said it best. I mean, because he wasn't a natural member of the majority, he was free to question everything about the way the society was organized. He didn't take things for granted because he just wasn't part of that majority, what he called the compact majority. And I think that led to revolutionary thinking and what's clearly a second renaissance in Western civilization, because the Jews happened to be in the ghetto for the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But, in the space of 20 years, I'll just list the names.
Mm-hmm.
In two cities, right, Vienna and Paris, you've got Freud, Mahler, Schoenberg, Proust, Einstein wasn't in those two cities, the invention of sociology with Emil Durkheim, and Kafka was briefly in Vienna. We think of him as in Prague, but in 20 years, it's hard to imagine that the 20th century's ideas would have existed. Western man's idea of himself from Freud and Einstein, the artistic expression of Proust and Kafka and Mahler and Schoenberg, absolutely defined an entire century. I mean, it's an astonishing thing to happen in one small minority of people, less than 1% of the population of Europe, in the space of 20 years. And what they all had in common was that they were the third generation out of the ghetto. Many of them were descended, by the way, from rabbis. But all of them had had that immigrant kind of experience that Americans take for granted, you know, except that instead of, you know, getting in ships and traveling across oceans and, you know, coming out of the bowels of the ship looking at the Statue of Liberty, they went 20 miles down the road and were allowed to live in a new town for the first time in 500 years. But it was the immigrant experience.
Even though it wasn't, it was a very short distance, you know, just outside
the neighborhood. Exactly. I mean, you know, immigration, it's great journeys, but, you know, it can be a very short walk to a new language, a new culture, a new set of rights, and a completely new identity. And that, to me, is what the immigrant experience is all about.
The Jews in the French ghetto before 1789 didn't speak French. They spoke Yiddish, or...
Well, they spoke a variant of Yiddish. They learned Hebrew. Hebrew was the language of school and learning. They spoke enough French to get by because, I mean, the typical Jewish life in eastern France was, I mean, eastern France, where the Ashkenazic Jews were living, was sort of like the Mississippi of Europe. I mean, it was... The segregation and depression was the worst there. And, you know, you couldn't work the land. You couldn't own any property. You were forbidden all trades except money lending and peddling. And so, you know, the typical life was a guy would leave home on a Sunday with some goods on his back, and he'd walk a circuit of 100, 150, 200, you know, miles around Alsace and Lorraine, and he'd stop off in this place and he'd trade one thing, and he'd stop off in another place and trade something else that he picked up in the first place. Along the way, he had something that passed for money, because remember, there is no national coinage. And, you know, he would lend some money, and between planting and harvest, you know, he'd stop in a town and some peasant might need something like money so he could buy something for his family, and he would lend the money at interest, and he'd come back and he'd collect the debt. I mean, it was like that. So you needed to speak a little bit of French to do that much trade. But in terms of affluency and reading ability, by and large, most people didn't. And one of the very first things that was required of Jews when they were let out of the ghetto is they had to send their children to mixed schools, which sounds like, you know, through modern eyes,
busing.
Yeah, this is a good thing. But remember, this is not necessarily a good thing, because the form of education, for the most part, inside the ghetto, was you learn to read by learning to read the Torah and the Talmud. So you're getting an indoctrination in the holy books. Now you're getting a more secular education. And by the way, this is a dilemma, you know, that Europe's new Muslim immigrants are facing. You know, a lot of this controversy about madrasas, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, does the state have the right to compel you to send your kid to a school where the curriculum is secular when you think, you know, I have freedom to worship as I please, and part of my worship says I want my kid to learn to read and write by memorizing the Quran?
Right.
You know, it's a dilemma.
Yeah. We're talking with Michael Goldfarb, and his book is called Emancipation, How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. So were there, in the same way that you're speaking of Muslims today, were there Jews who rejected emancipation and didn't want
it? In a way, yes. I mean, the first thing that happened after Napoleon basically liberated most of Western Europe's Jews was... the Jewish religion went through nothing less than a reformation as dramatic, if not as bloody, as the reformation initiated by Martin Luther in the Christian church. Everything was up for redefinition. And so there were many traditionalists, particularly in the countryside, those who didn't go straight to the cities once they were allowed to live in the cities without restriction, who wanted to cling to the old ways. And there were rabbis, famous rabbis, who inveighed against those who left behind the traditional ways. So for about 40 years, there was real controversy. And this is the beginning of Reform Judaism, and the Reformers referred to the traditionalists as Orthodox Jews, and that's where these terms start coming into use. Of course, the Orthodox Jews said there's no such thing as an Orthodox Jew, there's just a Jew, and you, Reformer, are an apostate from Judaism. But in the end, you know, this is going to sound really cliched, but I kind of like this one. I mean, the tide of history just swept everybody up.
Uh-huh.
And for once, it was running in the favor of Jewish people, because the skills necessary in the 19th century for success, as Europe made its transition into the modern era, were precisely the skills that the Jews had had to learn just to survive in the ghetto. You needed to be good at capital formation. Well, even the peddler, you know, knew how to handle money. You needed to move goods across borders. And Europe, the map of Europe, even in 1848, at the time, that year of revolution, is nothing like, you know, the map of Europe that we think of when we're planning a vacation. You know, there were dozens of principalities still, and feudal manors and things, and each had its own little tax and its own little, you know, way of dipping into the pockets of people trying to do money, do business across borders. And, you know, because the Ashkenazic world stretched from France deep into Russia, people, you know, the Jews were in a better position to do the kind of international trading that was becoming very common in the middle of the 19th century. And so they were, you know, they were forced to modernize. And these questions about how you stay true to the traditions while becoming integrated into the secular world kind of disappear by the middle of the 19th century. And so you have, you know, an established orthodoxy, an established reform synagogue, things in between. And so the Jewish population embraced this new world because, you know, frankly, they had no sentimental attachment to the old one.
So this period of emancipation, which takes, what, 100 years for it all to come around, or longer?
Yeah, I think that in the book, what I've done is I've kind of found this arc of a story that runs from just the eve of the French Revolution to the end of the Dreyfus Affair. The Dreyfus case ended in 1906 when Captain Dreyfus, who was a French Jew who was accused of spying for Germany and sent to Devil's Island. And in one of those notorious cases at the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, anti-Semitism suddenly became an international cause, celeb, and his, you know, innocence became the stuff of, you know, really, truly international, global media interest. Anyway, he was freed from Devil's Island and continued to fight for his complete exoneration. And eventually Dreyfus was completely exonerated. He was restored to the army and given a promotion. And for me, that's sort of the end of this part of the story, because for the Jews of the time in Europe, this was the end of the story. We were let out of the ghetto. We struggled for three generations, and now anti-Semitism has finally been beaten. Dreyfus has been, the name of Dreyfus has been cleared, and we can embrace our modern life. And that is really the story of emancipation. And of course, the bitter irony is that anti-Semitism hadn't been completely defeated and would, you know, come back, you know,
in
three
the
decades
worst way
later,
possible, right?
In the most unimaginable way.
Yeah. Well, other than Napoleon, you know, who was it that was fighting for this emancipation? I mean, why was it granted?
Well, first of all, in the French Revolution, one of the real joys of researching this book was reading about these quite extraordinary figures who made the French Revolution. I mean, I think most Americans probably think of the French Revolution and they see a guillotine coming down on Louis XVI's head. But what they forget is that in the two or three years before that event, the the French were trying to make, in the middle of the old world, a revolution every bit as based on principles that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and James Madison would have recognized, as had happened in America. In fact, Thomas Jefferson was America's ambassador in Paris at the time that the Bastille was overthrown. And the guys who made this revolution were wonderfully articulate, incredibly educated men, many of them aristocrats. And some of the names will be known to America, like the Count Mirabeau, who had decided that liberty, equality, and fraternity meant precisely that. All men are brothers. There are universal principles that we extend to everyone, tolerance, and so on. And this meant that we had to extend them to this tiny minority who, you know, most Frenchmen never met a Jew, but they all hated them because, you know, you heard about them in the sermons. Everybody could, knew the Jewish moneylender and so on, or knew stories about the Jewish moneylenders. And, you know, these guys really went to bat in debates in the National Assembly to try and get Jews their rights. The Jacobins, again, we think of, you know, American Jacobins as the guys who sent Louis XVI and everybody else to the guillotine. They started sending one another to the guillotine. The Jacobins, you know, the hard left of the National Assembly, were the most potent, not just advocates in speeches, but in backstage, backroom parliamentary maneuverings to get Jews their rights. And, you know, Norman Podhoretz has this book out, Why Are Jews Liberals? Well, I mean, one of the answers is that in the first 50 years of coming out of the ghetto, consistently, those non-Jews who fought on behalf of Jewish equality tended to come from the liberal left of the spectrum. That's why. And people remember that. So that's in the French Revolution. And then, you know, throughout the period of that I write about, there were always articulate political leaders, writers, who advocated treating the Jews with tolerance. Many of them are not so well known now, but, I mean, even Otto von Bismarck, who, you know, has this reputation of being the Iron Chancellor, and who was actually more of a pragmatic politician than anything else, understood that it was important to give his commercial class, and Jews were, you know, the backbone in the middle of the 19th century of the burgeoning urban bourgeoisie, to give them the necessary rights they needed so that they could function properly and so that Germany could prosper. Because, you know, it's not well known, but I mean, Germany, the industrial powerhouse of Europe, didn't really become the industrial powerhouse of Europe until well into the 1860s. It was still trying to figure out how to get rid of all of these minor duchies and principalities and unite itself. And once it had been united under Bismarck, it became clear to all that it was necessary to have a strong commercial class, and the people with the most experience at that point in building commerce happened to be from the Jewish community.
Well, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating book. It's called Emancipation: How Liberating Europe's Jews from the Ghetto Led to Revolution and Renaissance. And the author is Michael Goldfarb. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, that was my pleasure. Thanks so much, Gary.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. And in the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Ms. Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne, and thanks to Michael Goldfarb for joining us this week. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night.